case this morning, which is Medical Protective Company versus Kim. Mr. Schroeder.
Good morning, Your Honors. The broadly and simply stated, the primary legal issue in this case is whether Medical Protective owes coverage to Dr. Kim for the underlying Jennings lawsuit. More specifically stated, the issue is whether the Illinois Appellate Court's decision in Continental Insurance Company versus Co-Regis Insurance Company compels the conclusion that Medical Protective does not owe coverage. In the Continental Insurance case, Co-Regis Insurance Company issued a claims-made policy to Clark Neuber, an accounting firm. Clark Neuber audited some financial statements during the Co-Regis policy period. The Co-Regis policy said that if the insured Clark Neuber had a reasonable basis to believe a claim or litigation would be filed against it, it was under a duty to report that to Co-Regis. And that is a type of acceleration provision to invoke claims made coverage that this court found proper in the National Union Insurance case. The Co-Regis policy also stated that any claims that were subsequently made would be considered as having been made and filed during the Co-Regis policy period. And during the Co-Regis period, Clark Neuber developed a reasonable basis to believe it would be held liable for its auditing of the Midisoft company financial statements, and it therefore reported that as a potential claim to Co-Regis within the Co-Regis policy term. Then during the Continental Insurance subsequently issued a consecutive claims made policy. During that subsequent policy period, a lawsuit formal litigation was filed against Clark Neuber. Continental, the Illinois Appellate Court held that Continental Insurance Company did not owe any insurance coverage because even though the lawsuit was filed during the Continental policy term, that filing related back to the Co-Regis policy period, again, because all of the alleged improper conduct occurred during the Co-Regis policy term. A potential claim was properly recorded during, actually, I believe this is, I'll turn this off, this might be my cell phone. I apologize, Your Honors. All of the alleged wrongful conduct occurred during...
Some district courts, that warrants a $500 contempt fine.
Well, I have it on vibrate, Your Honor. I think it's interference. Again, I'm sorry. But the wrongful conduct occurred all during the Co-Regis policy period, and again, therefore, the court said Continental, the subsequent insurer, did not owe coverage. In our case here, the FICO insurance policy was named Dr. Kim as an insured. It also contained an acceleration provision that said in the event any insured has a reasonable basis to believe litigation would be filed, it could, in fact, and was, in fact, under a duty to report that
but
to...
Isn't that the problem here, whether he had a reasonable basis to believe it was... I mean, the hospital took action, but it looks like he was sort of kept in the dark.
That is true, Your Honor. That is one distinction between this case and Continental Insurance. Here you have Dr. Kim, who did not know of the request by medical records submitted by Mr. Jennings and did not know that the hospital had reported as a claim. However, the terms of the FICO policy say any claim, all claims from the same medical incident shall be considered as having been made at the time the first claim is made against any insured. It is a relation back provision. All claims from the same medical incident and both the claim that the hospital reported and the filing of the lawsuit against Dr. Kim are the exact same medical incident. It arises from Dr. Kim's performance of a laparoscopic cholecystectomy on Terry Jennings.
Counsel, the language of the FICO policy does not operate as a limitation on your policy. And so your continuous focus in this case on whether the FICO policy provided coverage has nothing to do with whether your policy provides coverage. You need to focus on the language of your policy and the first filed claims made language and whether this claim falls within that. The fact that the claim may also fall within another policy is totally irrelevant.
I will address that, Your Honor, and respectfully, I disagree. The MedPro policy does say it applies to claims that are first filed during the policy period, and I will.
And this claim was first filed within your policy period, as that term is further defined in your policy.
The policy defines a claim filed during the policy period as being an actual claim for damages, a civil litigation.
And that's what happened here.
Yes, if the analysis stops there, then yes, MedPro is going to lose.
However, doesn't the analysis stop there?
Because of the Illinois Appellate Court's decision in Continental Insurance, because that same analysis could be applied to that case.
But and that was a fight between two insurance companies over which owed coverage. That's not what we have here. FICO is insolvent.
It is true that that is another difference. However, Dr. Kim is entitled to coverage under the FICO policy, whether it's...
That doesn't make him not entitled to coverage under your policy.
I think the Continental Insurance case supports that conclusion, Your Honor.
Didn't the Continental Court say that nowhere in this court's opinion do we state that claims made policies can never cover the same loss? They just claimed the idea that they couldn't both cover this loss.
That was a footnote in the Continental Insurance opinion, Your Honor, and it said that the court said we are not establishing a per se rule that two claims consecutive policies can never apply the same loss. And then they went on to note
essentially what you're claiming, isn't it?
Perhaps it is a matter of semantics, Your Honor. What I'm saying is the Continental Insurance case, that same rationale applies here. I don't think we need to decide whether it's a per se rule or not. The point is, in Continental Insurance, the appellate court said even though a claim was in fact filed, a lawsuit was in fact filed during the subsequent and consecutive policy period, that insurer still did not owe coverage because that filing related back to a prior potential claim that was reported during the previous claims made policy term. That's exactly what we have here.
I have a procedural question. As I understand it, your complaint asserted three counts, one for declaratory judgment, seeking a declaration of no coverage, one for reformation and one for rescission based on the alleged misrepresentation in the application by Dr. Kim. Is that a correct statement?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Then there was a counterclaim by Dr. Kim or a series of counterclaims for a declaration, essentially the opposite, that there is coverage, and then for penalties under the Illinois Insurance Code statute. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then there was a trial to a jury on just the misrepresentation issue?
Correct.
And the jury was only instructed to decide whether or not there had been a misrepresentation?
Yes.
Were the other claims tried to the court?
Yes. After the trial was held, MedPro filed a judgment for matter of law arguing that, essentially citing the Continental Insurance versus Co-Regis case, saying that as a matter of law there was no coverage under the MedPro policy. A motion for a new trial was also argued on the basis of the verdict for Dr. Kim on the misrepresentation issue in his application was erroneous.
Well, if there was a trial to the court on all the remaining claims, everything except the misrepresentation issue, why were there no findings of fact and conclusions of law entered into by the district court here? Just Rule 50 motions, apparently, which are procedurally inappropriate in this context if the trial was to the court on most of these claims.
I don't know why the court did not issue specific findings of fact and conclusions of law. The court's memorandum order made several findings that I guess loosely could be considered findings of fact. He said the judge said that because MedPro issued the policy after it was aware of the Jennings lawsuit, it cannot now seek to disclaim coverage.
Well, what did the parties ask the court to do? I mean, was this explicitly teed up as a trial to the court?
At
the same time you were trying the misrepresentation claim to the jury?
No, the filing of motions regarding the Continental Insurance versus Co-Regis Insurance case were filed after the verdict came back. The theory was if the jury were to find for MedPro, the other arguments would be moot. So it was after the jury verdict came back that MedPro then filed judgments on the
But the jury wasn't issue. The jury wasn't asked to
it was
to
not
decide
asked to,
anything other than whether there had been a misrepresentation.
That is right. That was, I think, by agreement of all the parties.
So what? How were the motions captioned? As motions for findings and conclusions under Rule 52 for following
a
court trial?
I don't think it was 52. I think it was I believe it was Rules 50 and 54 are the procedural mechanisms by which the post-trial motions, for lack of a better word, were presented to the district court.
But those apply when the jury is hearing the whole case, and a party contends that there should be, either if it's post-verdict judgment notwithstanding verdict, or if it's at the close of all the evidence, which is not what occurred here, that the case shouldn't even go to the jury in the first instance. I don't know how it procedurally applies in this context, if, in fact, you were trying those issues, those claims to the court.
It is a rather unique situation, Your Honor. Perhaps the motion on the legal issue of whether the continental insurance case applies should have been presented before the trial, and because if the court had ruled on us on that and, say, a summary judgment motion or something, the trial would have been mooted, but that's not the way it was decided to be done below.
Are there any factual disputes regarding the competing claims for declaratory judgment on coverage?
I don't think there's any factual disputes. I think, if anything, there's the only potential dispute I would think there is on the facts is what potentially concerning Dr. Kim's state of mind when he answered the questions, if even his state of mind is deemed to be relevant.
Well, that's a question on the misrepresentation aspect here.
On the legal issue of the contention that the Illinois Appellate Court's decision in Continental Insurance applies, I don't think there are any disputes of fact. The facts are what they are, and it's a matter of is this court going to decide that Continental Insurance applies or not.
They move for judgment as a matter of law. Isn't that correct? Is that really what the bottom line was?
Yes.
But based on a stipulation that there were no disputes of fact?
I don't think there was an explicit stipulation of the fact, but I think the net result of the submissions by the parties is that they did not argue there was any questions of fact as to, again, whether the Continental Insurance case should apply or not.
Well, and as far as the legal issue about coverage, the district court did not engage in any analysis of the language of your policy.
No, it did not. Again, I don't know why that occurred. The sentence from the district court's order I mentioned before is, I think, about as the close to the sum total of the court's analysis.
I mean, I suppose that's something we can do here if there are, in fact, no disputes of fact and everybody stipulates to that, but
I
don't know what the record says in that regard.
I don't think there are any disputes of fact. I'm sure Mr. Enloe and Mr. Kaufman will tell you what they think, but for this legal issue, I don't think there are any disputes of fact. The policy language is what it is. The fact that the hospital submitted a claim during the FICO period is beyond dispute. The fact that Dr. Kim didn't know that was done is beyond dispute. I submit that that's not relevant, because if you look at the FICO policy, and I know, Judge, you're not inclined to do that, but if you look at Continental Insurance, the court did exactly that and went beyond the mere fact that a lawsuit was filed and therefore that insurer must defend. That's not the Continental Insurance Court went beyond that and said that lawsuit relates back. That's the same argument we're making here, is that, granted, Dr. Kim was sued during the MedPro policy period, but that's not where the analysis has to stop. That's just where it has to start. And if you look at the Continental Insurance case, it's on all fours with us right here. And therefore, I think that as a matter of law, MedPro does not owe coverage, because the filing of the lawsuit relates back to the April of 01 reporting of the claim to FICO.
That was a case where there were two insurance policies, as I understand it, and it was a fight between two insurance companies about which one was primary, and the damages did not exceed one or the other. So you didn't have the same issue that we have here. Am I misstating the facts of that case? I think it was only one of the policies was going to be resorted to because the damages didn't exceed policy limits of one or the other of the policies, right?
The settlement in the Continental Casualty case, I believe you're right, was going to fall within one or the other. I don't believe, though, Your Honor, that was the basis or rationale for the appellate court's ruling there. And in our case,
but it has to be considered in the context of the facts. Only one of the policies was going to be implicated. And that's really not what we've got here.
Well, Your Honor, I think, again, I can only say that I don't think that's relevant here. If you assume that MedPro defended and paid some kind of money, and MedPro then went back and sued FICO, and putting aside FICO's insolvency for a moment. But say that happened, that would be procedurally more on point with Continental Insurance, and the fact that that's not what occurred as a matter of procedure, as a matter of the party alignment of the parties, I don't think should make a difference in whether that case should be applied here. And Dr. Kim cannot, in MedPro's position, run away from his coverage that he's entitled to under the FICO policy simply because he doesn't want it, or it is now, unfortunately, useless to him.
Apparently didn't know he had it.
He disclosed on his insurance application to MedPro that he was, in fact, insured by FICO. Now, I think the law will assume he's aware of the terms of his insurance policies or put him on notice to find out what they are, but I would submit, again, that's not... Whether he knew he had coverage or not doesn't change the fact that under the legal construction of the FICO policy, he did, in fact, have coverage. And if you assume, again, say MedPro's policy did not exist, Dr. Kim would be here saying to you what I'm saying to you right now is I'm entitled to coverage being Dr. Kim because the hospital reported a claim and my being sued relates back to that claim. The fact that I'm making that argument or MedPro's making that argument, again, is a procedural difference that I don't think changes the fact that the Continental Insurance case should apply to this case.
If you win, the Patient's Compensation Fund is on the hook. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. That is correct because FICO being insolvent, the guarantee fund takes over. But again, I suggest that that's not a relevant factor to consider because MedPro did not issue a policy saying that we'll promise to pay claims that are reported under a prior policy if that prior insurer is found to be insolvent. That's not the deal we made. I'm eating into my rebuttal time, so I'll stop now unless there's other questions.
Fine. Thank you, Mr. Short. Renlow?
Please, the court. This case, to me, in attempting to analyze this case from its inception, really, when I got involved, which was basically factually all these things had already occurred, it seems to me that there are two ways that I've tried to focus that have been helpful to me to try to decide what the actual issues are. The first is that we're dealing with construction of an insurance policy issued by Medical Protective to Dr. Kim. And the issue in the case is whether that policy provides coverage. The second perspective that's been helpful to me is when all of the factual determinations or events occurred, try to analyze in my own mind How was Dr. Kim involved in those? What did he know or not know, or what did he do or not do? Because the issue, as I say, is whether he has coverage under this medical protective policy. The sole support, as I understand what they're saying, for their position that they don't owe the coverage, because the hospital, unbeknownst to him, this risk management lady reported a potential claim, is apparently this Continental case. There are two Continental cases cited, but this Continental versus Carregas case. And I think that case has really no application because of two primary things. The Carregas, Continental and Carregas case involved two policies, and the issue, they were consecutive policies. The issue really was, as I recall it, whether the tender letter that was sent during the first policy period was sufficient to trigger coverage for the claims that were subsequently filed. And I think the court held that's the case. It did not involve, in any sense, a fact scenario where the issue really is whether a privately purchased liability policy of the insured, in this case Dr. Kim, provided coverage on its own force, regardless of what had been done by the employer of Dr. Kim, that is the hospital, with respect to this previous policy. And they seem to be taking the position here, and I believe have from the outside, that if the FICO policy did provide coverage, then the medical protective policy did not. And I don't think that's the law. I don't think the cases that we have cited to the court say that's the law. And I believe that the law is exactly to the contrary.
Before you get any further in your discussion of the legal analysis that applies here, maybe you can clear up the procedural problems that I identified with your opposing counsel. What is your understanding of what happened in the district court?
Okay. My understanding is that, well, first of all, when we filed our counterclaim had two counts. One was for declaratory judgment that there was coverage. The second was for breach of the insurance contract for failure to defend and the penalties. In that counterclaim, we asked for a jury trial. We then, before the case was, or when the case was set for trial, we then agreed, or in fact, I filed a motion to withdraw that jury demand. We agreed to have the court determine the matter. That motion was opposed by Medical Protective. They wanted a jury. And I think that, as I understood what took place basically the day we showed up for the trial and or perhaps the day we were picking the jury, the court determined that the real factual dispute in the case was whether there was a misrepresentation made on the application, and if so, whether that misrepresentation was material to the risk. Because under the Golden Rule versus Schwartz case, the Illinois Supreme Court case, when you're dealing with application language like we have here in the medical protective application, that is a subjective determination and a factual question as to what the doctor actually knew and thought when he answered that particular question. So the judge then decided, my understanding was that he was taking all of the proof that was presented during the trial in front of the jury, that he was going to consider all remaining issues and render a decision on those, so that the factual dispute in the case on the question of whether there was a misrepresentation, and if so, whether it was material, was to be decided by the jury.
And everybody agreed to that procedure?
That's the way the procedure went, and there were no objections. So I guess absent an objection, that's what happened.
So that could be construed as a stipulation that on every issue except for misrepresentation and materiality, there were no disputes of fact, and the court could resolve them as a matter of law? And we'll find that quasi-stipulation, non-objection somewhere in the record?
I don't know, to be quite honest about it, if it was ever addressed in that fashion.
It's pretty clear that the district court's decision doesn't read like findings of fact and conclusions of law.
That is correct. It was actually handled after the jury's verdict.
So it doesn't read like what we would expect under Rule 52, a court trial.
Right. That's right. It was handled, I think, as you are suggesting, as if the remaining matters were not in dispute factually,
and
remaining issues were questions of law.
And you would now agree that there are no disputes of fact other than the one that was presented to the jury?
I think that is correct.
And so that all that remains on the declaratory judgment is a legal analysis of whether there's coverage?
Yes, I would, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yeah. The chronology of what happened is not in dispute. I don't think the substance of what happened and each particular date that's involved is in dispute.
It's just the legal significance of it.
Yes.
And the only, which is not a question of fact, is that Dr. Kim was, as I mentioned initially, was kept in the dark, or not kept in the dark, but didn't know about the claims that the hospital had filed.
Yes, and I know that the rules say you don't want us to get into the facts much, but essentially, from his standpoint of the involvement, basically what happened here was he, of course, was aware of this surgical event. The thing that triggered the lady in the hospital risk management department to send this notice of claim, so-called, to FICO was the fact that the husband of the patient came in and requested the medical records. It was undisputed in the evidence that Dr. Kim was never made aware of that fact by anyone. The next thing that happened, as far as he was not aware, made aware of the fact that the lady had, or the husband had come and requested the records, or that the hospital sent this notice in. His next involvement is when he gets served with a copy of the declaratory judgment case in August of the following year, after the medical protective policy was effective in July. And at that point, he tendered the policy to Medical Protective. It developed that, and all this was unbeknownst to Dr. Kim, FICO, a claims person for FICO, then contacted the claims person for Medical Protective, said this is our policy, so that the Medical Protective, the lawyer Medical Protective had hired, then FICO started paying. Dr. Kim was aware, but nobody ever told him that from Medical Protective or anywhere else that they were rejecting his tender or of defense or indemnity, or that they considered his application to be to have a false answer on it or a false statement on it, so that they were going to rescind his policy. Nobody told him anything, and he had no understanding as to why all of a sudden this other insurance company was paying his lawyer. And then he called the, can't remember his title, but he was the upper level management claims person for Medical Protective, and said, look, who is my malpractice carrier going to be? And the only testimony was, at that point in time, he did not have an answer for him. This is after Medical Protective had already hired a lawyer to defend the claim. They knew, obviously, that the claim was pending. The testimony from Medical Protective's claims person before he did that was that he reviewed the underwriting file, which included the application, before he hired the lawyer. And still nobody says anything to him at that point. We're going to hire a lawyer for you under a reservation reserving our rights because you didn't disclose this or anything of the sort.
And materiality also went to the jury, the issue of materiality?
It was submitted in the alternative. The verdict form is in the back of our brief. Basically, it said, do you find that there was a misrepresentation? And if you answer that yes, the next question, do you find that it was a material misrepresentation? So because they answered the first question no, they never reached the other. But it was submitted.
This group of facts you just described is one I think Mr. Schroeder indicated there's no dispute about.
I believe that's correct, yes. Yes.
The question of materiality turns, at least to some extent, on the fact that that they went ahead and continued to process this application, even though the company knew what the facts were at that point. Is that right?
That is correct. I think the undisputed evidence is that this claim was, they had in their possession a copy of the complaint in the underlying case and had assigned a lawyer by approximately, it's either the 23rd or 27th of August, and that the 25th of September, and this is after they had reviewed the underwriting file, there was a binder of coverage issued from the broker's office back to Dr. Kim saying the policy had not been issued. And I think the evidence was nobody really was quite sure when that policy actually was mailed to Dr. Kim, but it was after September 25th, which was a considerable number of weeks after they had assigned a lawyer to defend the claim.
Counsel, would you address the district court's imposition of the statutory penalties for bad faith, breach of contract, or I guess under the Illinois statute, it's unreasonably and vexatiously breached the contract. That requires a finding that the insurance company did not reasonably debate this claim, that the claim was not reasonably debatable, as I understand the Illinois law, and there was no finding to that effect by the district court, nor did the district court even address the argument about coverage that the plaintiff was making in this case under the Continental case, nor did the district court even address the policy language itself, the first filed policy language and the further definition of that in the contract. So how can we affirm that aspect of it?
I think that the reason it can be affirmed is when you look at their policy language, the only conceivable argument they could have had was that Dr. Kim knew of a claim and didn't submit it, so they weren't going to have coverage during their policy period. Well, when you analyze what actually happened there, I think they thought when they filed this lawsuit that because the hospital had sent this notice of claim, they were somehow going to be able, maybe by definition, I don't know, that he was aware of that fact and all of those things. And they were never able to get anywhere close to that, and the undisputed evidence was that he had no such knowledge. So then there is no basis as the lawsuit proceeds that they can tag him with that notice that was sent by the hospital. It just never transpired. The other thing that I think the district court was correct about in finding this handling to be in bad faith was, I'm getting into my client or to his time here, but they went ahead and issued this policy, and then they filed a lawsuit saying if we had known of this claim, we wouldn't have issued this policy. The fact is they knew of the claim and issued it anyway, and they persisted in that posture throughout the entire case.
But the misrepresentation claim was tried to a jury on the basis of disputed facts and could have gone either way, at least arguably, based on the evidence here, and that would have provided a basis for reformation or rescission. So doesn't that arguably reasonably debatable issue preclude the imposition of penalties under the statute?
I don't see it that way because of the fact that they filed a complaint in this case that alleged facts that were contrary to the actions they had taken before they filed the complaint. And there again, they said, had we known of this policy or this claim, we would not have issued this policy. The fact is that the only evidence in what was in their file was that they had not only knew of the claim, they had assigned a lawyer to defend the claim, and then some 60 days later issued the policy.
Well, so how can the policy had already been bound. Well, the issuance of the policy came later, the physical act of issuing the policy, but the policy had already been bound before.
Well, the
company
binder was an exhibit. Is very explicit that the policy isn't going to be issued until it's approved in the home office. And like I say, all that information was available to them. If there are no other questions, I'll.
Thank you, Mr. Enloe. Mr. Kaufman. Mr. Kaufman, you can have your full 5 minutes if you need it.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Steve Kaufman. I represent the Illinois Guarantee Fund. We supported coverage on the part of Medical Protective in this case for obvious reasons. With FICO having gone insolvent, then the Illinois Guarantee Fund would, to an extent, statutorily implemented, be on the hook, if you will, for the Jennings claim. So we were in support of coverage in the case. On the morning of the first day of trial, the Medical Protective attorney came into court and basically dismissed us from the case. At the time, the Medical Protective attorney represented that if Dr. Kim is successful in this lawsuit, that Medical Protective would pay the Illinois Guarantee Fund's fees for defense in the underlying case. As shown by the trial transcript, the issue expressly reserved as between Medical Protective and the Illinois Guarantee Fund was whether or not the Guarantee Fund would be reimbursed for its fees and costs in the declaratory judgment action. Contrary to Medical Protective's position, there was no agreement that the Illinois Guarantee Fund would forgo its fees and costs in the DJ action if the case were dismissed and it did not have to participate in trial. The record, as we've cited in our briefs to the court, is very clear on that subject. By the court's order of May 10, 2005, the court awarded fees and costs to the Guarantee Fund for both the underlying action and the DJ action. Medical Protective appealed that order. The only argument that Medical Protective made in its appeal of this case was that there was an agreement between Medical Protective and the Guarantee Fund that the Guarantee Fund would not seek its fees and costs in the DJ action. As shown in our brief and as shown by the record, that argument was waived. It was never an argument made by Medical Protective in the underlying action. And quite to the contrary, the record specifically provides that that issue of fees and costs in the DJ action was expressly reserved. Public funds have been expended by the Illinois Guarantee Fund for defense of the underlying action as well as the DJ action. We would ask the court to affirm the ruling of Judge Murphy in its order of May 10 of 2005. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kaufman. Mr. Schroeder? Mr. Schroeder, I'll give you two additional minutes if you need it.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. The first comment you, Your Honor, had made during Mr. Enloe's argument was about Dr. Kim, quote-unquote, being kept in the dark. I'm not going to beat a horse, but I'll just stand to what I said before about how whether he knew about the policy terms or what had been reported or not, the fact is he's entitled to coverage under the FICO policy. Another comment was made about by Mr. Enloe that Medical Protective never went to Dr. Kim and said, you know what, we owe you no coverage. And Mr. Enloe suggested that somehow should be held against Medical Protective. I think if you look at the facts, that's not that conclusion does not follow because on October 10th of 2001, Paul Lynch, the attorney that Medical Protective had in fact retained, who was then later in about mid-September of 01 retained by FICO, told Dr. Kim, FICO's paying me, they are defending you, not MedPro. That is in the record pages, document 111, pages 199 to 201. The point is, MedPro did not just abandon Dr. Kim and leave him high and dry and throw him to the wolves. He had an attorney, he had an insurance company stepping up to defend him and did in fact defend him, but for the obvious liquidation, that'd still be going on. Judge, you had made a comment about the materiality issue and how that in part turns upon Medical Protective's knowledge of the existence of the Jennings lawsuit. I think that the inquiry needs to go a little further because while MedPro certainly knew of the Jennings lawsuit very early on, That is not the same as saying Medical Protective knew that because of the Continental Insurance case and unique terms of the FICO policy and the fact that the hospital had reported the potential
claim.
They
issued him an insurance policy, didn't they?
Well, you can issue an insurance policy.
They made these alleged misstatements.
But we didn't know.
How can they be material, and that's the issue.
The mere fact that we know about the case doesn't mean we should have known simultaneously that Dr. Kim should have disclosed that case in his application. We shouldn't have to assume that Dr. Kim has withheld something or deceived us when he submitted his application. All we knew is that a case
well,
came
the
in.
The issue isn't whether he's an honest doctor or not. The issue is what are the facts that he has asserted to be the facts. And if you have accepted those facts and are prepared to issue a policy based on them, I don't see how they're very material.
Well, all we knew was the lawsuit had been filed. Upon further investigation, when FICO told us, hey, this is our case, and then when we looked into it more, and when Dr. Kempin came back to us and said, FICO's gone, I want you guys to come back and defend me, we looked at it some more and realized, hey, wait a minute, given the nature of this case, we think Dr. Kim should have disclosed this when he submitted his application. Now we've got a materiality issue. Now we can say something about it. But again, I don't think it's fair to say that simply because we knew the lawsuit, we should have assumed that Dr. Kim was being dishonest when he submitted his application and did not disclose that as a potential claim in his application.
Well, it just doesn't seem to me the issue is basically whether Dr. Kim is honest or dishonest. The issue is what are the facts under which you issued the policy. If you issued the policy knowing what the facts were, then how can you say that a representation of the facts to the contrary was material? Do you understand?
I understand what you're saying. I think we're just quibbling about what were the, quote, facts.
No, we're not quibbling over the facts. You're saying the important thing is what was in Dr. Kim's mind when he made these representations. And I'm saying if you made the representations, you proceeded to do whatever you did based on those facts, which you knew, not necessarily from his representations, but from other sources. So how could they be material?
Because at the time we retained an attorney to defend him, which was the day or two after the claim, the lawsuit was sent to us, we had no reason to believe that he had done anything improper in his application. Regarding the issue of statutory penalties, I agree with Judge Sykes that the district court arguably did not set forth any basis for its conduct, for its ruling. I think I'll stand in Continental Insurance, and even if Your Honors decide it doesn't apply, I think its similarity to this case is more than enough to show that MedPro did not act in either statutory bad faith or the common law bad faith that was addressed in Mr. Enloe's brief, and therefore, at worst, I think MedPro, if you rule against MedPro, the award of attorney's fees and costs should be vacated nonetheless. That's all. If you have any questions, otherwise, I'm all done.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thanks to all counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.